Discussion with Derek. Brought to you by Stanlib.
Welcome to everybody to the Stanlib community, and it's really great for you to join us again. Today we are talking about one of the most topical issues in South Africa today. We're still under a pandemic. It seems like it's tapering off, but we're still worried about the fourth wave, which authorities are talking about. But more importantly, we've got to decide whether to vaccinate or not to vaccinate. South Africa at the moment does not have a COVID-19 vaccination policy, but other vaccination certificates are required for children going to school. Recently, there's some prominent companies which have drawn a line in the sand. Discovery becoming the first listed company on the JSE to mandate vaccination for its staff. Soon after that, we had that Old Mutual and Sanlam followed in their footsteps. But we as a company, Stanlib, or for that matter, the broader Liberty Group, have not yet taken a stance on this. The key question is that what is our responsibility to Stanlib employees, to their families, and to society? So today I'm joined by Professor K. Mantri Mundli, who is a distinguished professor in the Department of Medicine and the director of the Center for Medical Ethics and Law at the Faculty of Health Sciences at Stellenbosch. It is a rather unusual combination of someone who has studied medicine and is a medical practitioner, but is also well-versed in ethics and in law, which is a very interesting combination of dealing with the issue of whether to vaccinate or not. She's a specialist family physician, a bioethicist, and has served as a principal in investigator on clinical trials. She's an accomplished researcher, having been given research and capacity development grants to the value of 40 million rand, and serves on a number of scientific advisory committees. Welcome to you, Prof. But maybe, Prof, just before we start, your background and your qualifications and what you are doing is a confluence of three different disciplines: law, medicine, and I don't know where ethics lie in, whether they are part of philosophy or they're part of the social sciences. Do you mind giving us a bit of a background on how these three things ended up coming together under your qualifications? And more importantly, how do they inform your views on how we should be responding to the issue at hand?
Good morning, Derek, and thank you very much for the invitation to discuss these important issues with you. So I trained as a medical practitioner, and I was a medical student more than 30 years ago at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and subsequently moved to Cape Town and continued my work and specialized as a family physician. But during the course of my work, there were many, many ethical issues that were arising. And I then went off to philosophy, to the philosophy department at Stellenbosch University, to study ethics in more detail. And so completed a master's and a doctorate in ethics. And of course, more recently, I did an MBA at UCT. And along the way, I think I did a certificate in medical law through UNISA. And I think all of these disciplines have, merged in a very interesting way to assist me to better understand many aspects of healthcare in South Africa. And so much of my work internationally with the World Health Organization and with other bodies globally, as well as with national bodies, has helped me to better understand the COVID pandemic in particular, and the impact on society, the impact on our healthcare system, and the impact on our economy. And of course, vaccines became a very important aspect of the pandemic. And so I gave this considerable thought and read very widely around the topic.
But vaccinations are not anything new. Historically, we've been vaccinated against smallpox and against all kinds of other diseases. Even if I want to travel to certain countries today, I'm obligated to show a, when I travel to say Nigeria, I'm obligated to show a yellow fever certificate, otherwise they won't let me into the country. Why is this particular vaccination debate getting to be so divisive?
Yeah. So I think there are a number of different reasons for that, Derek. Firstly, childhood vaccinations have been standard practice around the world. There are many countries in the world where vaccines for children for over 11 different diseases are mandatory. There are also many countries in the world where vaccination for children is mandatory for school entry. So in South Africa, we know we all produce school certificates of vaccination for our children when they go to school as a requirement. It's not really legislated, but it is a requirement for school entry, even in South Africa. I think the difference with COVID vaccines is that they are specifically started off being specifically for adults. And adults are not very, you know, accustomed to vaccines. Yes, people have taken flu vaccines, but I think the concern with the COVID vaccines for many is that they were developed very quickly and that they were a new type of vaccine that people, some people, were a little bit uncertain about. But I think over the past 8 months in South Africa with vaccine rollout and with various webinars, conversations, media reports, social media reports, there has been considerable discussion around vaccines. And I think the concern about COVID vaccines having been developed very quickly should have been adequately explained by now. We do know that the vaccine development was stimulated by large financial investment. And for any medical product, for any vaccine, one requires a considerable financial investment in order to get the vaccine produced or the medication produced. What happened with the COVID vaccine, given that there was a public health emergency affecting all countries in the world, is that many governments financed the development of vaccines very quickly, very generously, that quickened the pace at which vaccines were developed. Then again, there were also a whole host of technologies that had been developed over decades. So scientists around the world have been working on the mRNA technology for many, many decades. And so this was a good opportunity with COVID to use this technology that was tested and tried in laboratories on a new vaccine. And this type of approach ended up speeding up development of the COVID vaccine. So there were no shortcuts taken. As you indicated when you introduced me, I've been working in clinical trials for more than a decade, and I understand the clinical trial development process very well. It is extremely rigorous, and one cannot simply, you know, develop a drug and market it. There's a very long process involved. There are, you know, various stages of testing, starting with laboratory testing to animal testing to human testing. And there are important bodies around the world like the Food and Drug Administration in the USA, FDA. And in South Africa, we have SAHPRA, which is the equivalent of the FDA that approves drugs. And a whole host of research ethics committees that also approve protocols for these new drugs and new vaccines. So it undergoes rigorous evaluation and assessment throughout the process. And we have a wide range of COVID vaccines today that are not all experimental vaccines. Many of the vaccines now have full registration with various regulatory bodies. And so, you know, that is how COVID vaccines have evolved and developed so quickly over the past 2 years.
Do you think it was a mistake to start talking about mandatory vaccine while some of the vaccines were hadn't gotten full approval? Because a lot of them were originally approved for emergency use. And then we started talking about mandatory vaccination when some of them had not actually moved to being full use. Do you think it was a mistake to, as I say, put the cart before the horse here? That ideally we should have waited until they are all fully sort of approved and they've moved away from being for emergency use? much.
So I think what we need to understand about a public health emergency is that it is an emergency. So there's no time. We don't have time. You know, this is my biggest argument about mandatory vaccine policies, that time is not on our side. That the longer we wait, the more we will have development and evolvement of variants of the virus. And because of this urgency, we have to act much faster than we do in pre-pandemic times. And so it is this urgency with which we need to work. So vaccines were administered even when they were under emergency use authorization. And then a few started getting full authorization. But if we sat and waited for every single COVID vaccine to be fully registered, I think many, many millions of people would have died around the world. And as things stand, we know that the vaccines have been given to billions of people. If we look at one country like India alone, over a billion people have received the vaccine. And in normal drug development, the drug may be tested on thousands of people, not millions. So this is an unusual situation in that we have vaccines that have been given to millions and billions of people in some cases. And so we have so much evidence that in most cases, the vaccines work very well in preventing COVID-19 infection. There are some side effects with some of the vaccines, but these affect very few people. And they're extremely rare and uncommon. So this is a situation that exists with any other drug. So we all know people take drugs for high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, etc. And all of these drugs come with good benefit, but they also have side effects. And depending, you know, it differs from one person to another exactly which side effects one will get. But it's always what we call a risk-benefit ratio, that we have to balance the risks against the benefits and make a decision to use a drug or not to use a drug. And I think this applies equally to COVID vaccines. They're no different. There is no COVID vaccine that is 100% effective. They all have some level of, you know, side effects ranging from mild to moderate to more severe. And if people have specific underlying conditions, these side effects may be worse in some than in others.
Yeah, so let's get to the nub of the conversation today. So this was a useful introduction. You are a medical ethicist. And so I don't want to talk about what the law says and what the law doesn't say. I want to talk about what is an ethical thing to do. Because at times what the law says might not be what people consider to be ethical for a whole range of reasons. So you bring a very interesting aspect, which is in terms of ethics, should we be making mandatory, should we be making vaccination mandatory? From an ethical point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a very important consideration. I think from an ethical perspective, the first thing we look at is safety and efficacy. So in terms of looking at the ethics of any product, the important principle in ethics is first do no harm. And so to ensure that a vaccine is safe and efficacious is critical. That's the starting point. Once we've established that, we then look at, well, look at South Africa. Do we have an adequate supply of vaccines? Absolutely. Do we have good access to vaccines? Yes, in most cases, access is good, but is being improved, you know, by ensuring that rural communities and populations get access, by ensuring that there are pop-up vaccination sites, and by an attempt to bring vaccines closer and closer to the people, which is very important. Then there must be, a free supply of vaccines. So as we all know, in South Africa, we can access vaccines anywhere for free. And this is important. So from that's almost one of the first ethical requirements of considering a mandatory vaccine policy. Then the second important issue is to look at a public health ethics framework. So When we are facing an emergency such as this pandemic, we have to use a different ethics approach, which is called a public health ethics framework, in which we look not at individual rights, but rather look at what is in the best interest of the public and of society and the community. So it's a different approach in that we work towards the common good, because so many people are affected by this pandemic. We already know that around the world, millions of lives have been lost. And so this is something that affects everybody. And when we move into that kind of scenario, then we have to think about the common good. And so individual rights can be limited under these circumstances. Now, this principle applies ethically. It applies in terms of human rights, and it applies in terms of the law. So this is one example where ethics, the law, and human rights are all, you know, in agreement with each other in terms of the fact that we can limit individual rights. So we have in terms of the public health ethics approach, the principle of limiting autonomy. And we've all had this happen to us during the pandemic. So we've been subjected to lockdowns, to isolation, quarantine, mandatory mask wearing. All of this has limited our individual rights. And so the same applies if we think about vaccines.
But Prof, when we agreed to have those rights limited to us, we were fed all kinds of very scary stories of what would happen to us if we didn't do that. So we were a lot more compliant. It was a new virus that we're dealing with, and it was unprecedented. But right now, we are getting a lot more knowledgeable around what's happening around us. The science is getting better, and therefore, maybe we have got the right to be a lot more skeptical of what the authorities are telling us, and to be a lot more stronger in terms of enforcing our individual rights.
Unfortunately, irrespective of whether, you know, in fact, the issue is the science is telling us more and giving us more evidence about why it's good to have a vaccine. So there will be skepticism. There always is in healthcare. Anti-vaxxers are not a new phenomenon. Anti-vaxxers have been around long before COVID. And so there are all kinds of, you know, conspiracy theories that circulate about various vaccines, etc. It just seems to have mushroomed in the context of the pandemic. Now, yes, we can. Science is evolving. We are learning more. But people are still dying. And if we look at Europe now, they are having the most horrendous fourth wave. And so even though we are 2 years into the pandemic, as long as there is a virus causing severe disease and death, we need to be very, very cognizant of the fact that individual rights are not going to be the most important consideration. In fact, it's regarded as rather selfish under these circumstances if we want to enforce individual rights and not take responsibility for the health and the lives of other people in society. And so even though science has advanced and more vaccines are being developed, more and more treatments are being developed, the approach for limiting individual rights, the principles that support this limitation are still in place and still relevant. And there was an article published recently with bioethicists from over 90 bioethics centers in the United States who have all concluded that it is ethical to limit rights, even at this point in the pandemic. And it was published a week ago.
I just want to ask an interesting question about whether this idea of mandatory vaccination is not arbitrary.
Well, it's not arbitrary because it's historically been around since the 19th century. So to bring smallpox, as you know, smallpox is now eliminated. And how did we do it? It started off in 1806 with smallpox vaccines being mandatory in the United States. And over time, you know, various mandatory vaccine policies have existed in different parts of the world. So there's nothing new about vaccine mandates. They're a known phenomenon, and there is evidence that a mandate can increase vaccine uptake by between 18 and 20 percentage points. So I'm sure you've heard about different countries offering incentives of various forms.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so we know, you know, incentives will work in some cases, but the same incentive will not work in all communities. Firstly, as from an ethics perspective, it should not be necessary to offer somebody an incentive to improve their health or to protect their health or to protect the health of others. It's something as human beings that we should want to do whether or not we were offered anything. So an incentive in the first place, you know, is not really something that one considers to be ethical. But if it will help, and it does help in a very small number of cases, so incentives will increase uptake by between 3 and 5%, and that's what the studies have shown. And so the important thing is that we know some incentives work with some communities and they don't work with other communities. So it's really very difficult to decide, you know, what incentive to offer. If we're going to make it easier for people to access vaccine sites, for example, by giving a transport voucher or helping people in some way to get to the site or getting a cup of coffee or at the site or giving people something while they're waiting, you know, those are reasonable incentives, but very large amounts of money are not considered to be ethical in general. So yes, incentives will work, and I certainly have nothing against them if they're small and reasonable and make people's lives better. But we are sitting at a 33% level of vaccination amongst our adult population. So if we look at the number of adults in South Africa who are fully vaccinated, we're around 33 to 34%, and it's almost the end of November. The government was hoping to reach a 70% level of full vaccination for our adult population by December. We are nowhere near that, and we are never going to reach that level. And that's because we've been too slow to implement vaccine mandates. In France, we've seen how vaccine mandates increased uptake of vaccines by 20%. So that's the data and the evidence that exists to show that they work.
But Prof, I could take a contrarian view to one of incentives, which is saying, well, if incentives don't work, the idea of introducing penalties and denying people certain privileges is also unlikely to work. Why is it that the concept of mandatory vaccination tends to have a bias towards saying, if you're not vaccinated, you're going to be denied a whole lot of privileges?
Mm-hmm. Because that's how
is that ethical?
Absolutely, that's how it works, because the denial is intended to protect the lives and the health of other people. So everything about vaccine mandates is related to ensuring that when people go into specific indoor venues, for example, where the risk of transmission is higher, that those who are not vaccinated cannot enter because they're a risk to other people. And why are they a risk even to the vaccinated? Because all vaccines are not 100% effective. And that is why we are still promoting the wearing of masks. And in South Africa, it's mandatory. We've seen in other countries where they let go of masking that we have a resurgence of infection. So because of that, and because in South Africa, we have an Occupational Health and Safety Act, which requires that everybody has a right to a safe working environment. Even the Constitution talks about everybody having a right to a safe working environment. And this means employees and employers. So the protection has to be for everybody. And our legislation and our ethics frameworks support this level of limitation of rights when the lives and the health of other people are at risk. So I hope that...
And who decides that in a democracy like ours, why should that decision on the personal privilege versus the public peril be decided by someone else? Why shouldn't I decide that as me, as Derek, instead of having some person sitting where I never see them coming up and issuing a directive or a piece of legislation?
Well, the part of the, we have an ANC government in power. They have made the Department of Labor issued the first directive in June of this year already, allowing various industries and workplaces to institute a vaccine mandatory policy. So this started quite a while ago, and it's part of the democratic decision-making process because our constitution has a built-in limitation clause. And this is what many people don't understand about the constitution. People think that the constitution gives them a right to do anything at any point, as you know, whenever they feel like it. But it doesn't. It lists 27 different rights, but it does not give us the right to infect other people or the right to put other people's lives at risk. In fact, the right to life is an inderogable right. And so we cannot put other people's lives at risk. And the limitation clause in the Constitution is very well written and very clear and has legally been implemented already. So we have legal precedent for that. So it's
how relevant is
following our Constitution.
How relevant is that clause to the debate here today?
Extremely relevant. It has everything to do with the debate because people believe that individual rights cannot be limited. The Constitution tells us otherwise. And that is why leading constitutional lawyers in South Africa strongly support vaccine mandates, because they understand the Constitution, they've read it properly, and they know that we have very good justification for limiting individual rights. You cannot simply limit somebody's rights unless you meet certain criteria. And with COVID, we have met all of those criteria. And that is why it is both ethically and legally justifiable.
Do you mind sharing what, as part of the education for those who are very strong in terms of personal rights,
yes,
and personal privilege, on the criteria that is applicable in mandatory vaccination, that means that the individual rights are actually curtailed.
Correct. So the United Nations Committee on Social and Economic Rights in 1985 developed a set of principles that is referred to as the Syracuse Principles. And there are sort of five major principles. When we need to limit individual rights in a situation like a public health emergency, we have to firstly ensure that the limitation is based in law. And in South Africa, we have enough evidence that it is legal to limit rights because our constitution, which is the highest law in the country, allows for that. Mm-hmm. Then, when we limit rights, there must be a legitimate objective. So it must be, in this case, to reduce the spread of disease, to protect the lives of others, and to ensure that, you know, people are healthy and safe. So that is the objective around a mandatory policy in the context of a pandemic. It must then be strictly necessary. So we know, with all the variants that are developing and the spread of infection, that we need some measures in place to ensure that we limit spread. And so that is a strictly necessary requirement. It must be the least restrictive. And of course, there the argument about incentives comes in. So are incentives not less restrictive than a mandatory vaccine policy? Yes, they are, but they are not as effective. And so we go on to the last point, which is that the limitation must not be arbitrary, as you mentioned earlier. So that means it must not be arbitrary. It must be based in science. And there must be good evidence that the vaccine will work. And we already have that evidence from billions of people having received the vaccine and being protected from it. So in a nutshell, those are the principles that support limitation of rights.
So you're a practitioner in medicine and medical ethics. What do you see as a direction of travel here? Are we bracing ourselves for mandatory vaccination, or do we think that in the fullness of time, this too shall pass and we'll revert to where we are?
If we look at the global scenario around the world, mandatory vaccine policies are becoming more and more widespread. In fact, in Europe, there are now lockdowns for the unvaccinated. So we know what a lockdown is when it applies to everybody in society. Mm-hmm. But Europe in the last few weeks has instituted policies where lockdown measures apply only to the unvaccinated because the hospitals, the ICUs are being overwhelmed with unvaccinated people. And so the evidence is just so clear throughout the world that, you know, being unvaccinated is a huge risk. And so mandatory policies are in place and South Africa is lagging seriously behind. We know that there are some institutions that have already started applying the policies. Mediclinic, which has 52 hospitals, has developed their mandatory policy. We know Discovery Health has done it. Other businesses are following suit. And all the major universities are planning to have a mandatory policy in place by 2022. So entry onto campus is going to be limited. That affects me directly. So, for example, on our campus, you know, we would want to teach a class with 100% vaccinated students, if as far as possible, because the people who teach at universities are older. They have comorbidities. They're at higher risk. And we cannot risk being infected by young students who refuse to take a vaccine. So having a policy in that environment is extremely important. And this is why our major universities, WITS, UCT, Stellenbosch, and others are developing and working hard around these policies and are planning to implement them in 2022.
That's useful. I want to just get to the issue of exemptions, which is if you have a mandatory policy, mm-hmm. is it really still fair to have exemptions? And is it really just that some other people, for whatever reasons, can be exempted from that? Mm-hmm. And really, what are the most important considerations for allowing exemptions?
Well, in any policy, one would have to make provision for exemptions because there are a very, very, very few people who will have medical reasons that will make them exempt from the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so far, the most important medical exemptions are if somebody has an allergy to a specific component of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So that is extremely specific. The other requirement is if you've had a very serious allergic reaction to the first dose of a vaccine, where you required to be resuscitated, you know, that's how severe the reaction had to be, then that is one another medical reason for exemption. Apart from that, there are no major medical reasons why one could not take a COVID vaccine. And then, of course, there are some people who claim a religious objection. Now, there too, most major religions in the world do not object to a COVID vaccine. And in fact, many of the major religions have issued statements indicating that there is no objection to COVID vaccines. There are some people who have argued that that fetal cells that were, you know, came from aborted fetuses 30 years ago were used in development of drugs and vaccines. And so some claim a religious objection in that respect. What is important is that not any of the current COVID vaccines contain cells from aborted fetuses. The research has been done and development may have used cell lines that were developed many years ago, but none of the vaccines actually contain those cells. And what is also interesting is that many other drugs that we use were developed in the same way, using those same cell lines over time. So simple things like aspirin, Tylenol, Brufen, Zoloft, Benadryl, the drugs that everybody takes, you know, they were developed in the same way, which completely kills the argument around fetal cells being used in vaccine development. Because then if we're not going to take the COVID vaccine for that reason, we must also not take all the other medications that were developed in a similar way. So I think we're on very shaky ground where religious objections are concerned. There are no very specific reasons why one would be religiously exempt from a vaccine. And one would certainly have to prove that one's religion forbade it in one way or another.
Thank you. Just on the issue of enforcement, South Africa has got unfortunately a history of enforcing laws, and South Africans generally have got I stand to be corrected, a low tolerance for compliance with things that are imposed on them, whether it's sticking to traffic laws, etc. We generally are seen as a nation which just hates to be told what to do and be forced to comply. Mm. What are the ethical considerations around enforcing compliance with the vaccine, with the mandatory vaccination mandate?
I think if the objective is important enough, and that objective is to save lives, it's like we're not allowed to drive without seatbelts. There are many rules that govern our behavior in society. We have very strong smoking legislation here in South Africa. In fact, more strict than many European countries. So South Africa has actually got many, many laws that are intended to protect us, protect lives, and protect health. And so those public health measures that we already have in place in South Africa are generally adhered to. And we know what the penalty is. You drive without a seatbelt, you're going to get a fine. Specific corrective actions in place for violating the law. And so that is the type of society we are, as far as I know. Yeah, there are people who always try to break the law. We know that. And they pay the price for it later. So likewise with COVID vaccines and with vaccine policies, people are free to break the law if they want, but then they pay the price for it. And if we look at who's sitting in the ICUs and who's hooked up to ventilators and which people cannot breathe and are fighting for their lives, it's to a large extent unvaccinated people. So you break the rule, you pay the price. It's that simple. And if you want to pay the price with your health or with your life, it's also your choice.
But generally in South Africa, most of the people listening and listening to this podcast, half of them have probably not paid their TV license and they've got no intentions of doing it. Those in Gauteng, 70% of them have not paid their e-tolls and have got no intentions of doing so. So compliance is something that is, I wouldn't say endemic, but it's something that is a real challenge to enforce. How do we improve the chances of enforcing what we consider to be something that is a public of public interest for all of us?
Look, that's an important question, Derek. And we need to, the whole question around mandates is that you need evidence of vaccination. So you need proof of vaccination to gain entry. It's that simple. You have to show the proof. So I'm hosting a big international conference in a week's time. And our rule for the conference is you can attend in person only if you have shown us proof of vaccination. If you cannot show us proof of vaccination, you are welcome to still attend the conference, but virtually. So then you are a risk to nobody else. So the people who are attending in person are, going to have to be able to show proof and to comply with the requirement. And that's how it's worked, and it's working very well. It's the way you have to have, a specific rule in place. There is a choice, so it's not like people are being forced. This is what you can do if you are vaccinated, and if you can't be vaccinated, this is the alternative. So likewise, even in industry and in various health work settings, the alternative is to have weekly PCR COVID testing. In some parts of the world, you have to have it twice a week. So you can choose to be vaccinated, or if you have a choice not to be vaccinated, there is an alternative, and that is testing regularly, either weekly or twice weekly, depending on the policy. So there are alternatives and there are choices involved here, and people make their choices.
But we make it quite punitive for those who are unvaccinated. Is that deliberate?
It's not deliberate. It's a health reason. I mean, it's very simple. We cannot afford to overwhelm our public and private healthcare systems in this country. I think people who are outside the health sector don't understand the impact of this pandemic on our health system.
Can you give us a color? Can you give us a color on that? On the impact that some of these choices have on people who maybe we don't see. Let's just talk about health workers. One particular anecdote. Health workers losing sympathy for people not vaccinated and saying, you know, as much as they have, as individuals, have committed to saving lives, but at times when they get to people who have decided not to be vaccinated and have had the opportunity to do so and fall sick, health workers are just saying it is unnecessary toll on them to have to deal with that.
Absolutely. So people worked really hard during the first wave in South Africa. I mean, healthcare workers worked long hours in full PPE. I think somebody needs, you know, people who are outside of health need to put on a set of full PPE and walk around in the summer heat and know what it's like to work in an enclosed hospital with a high amount of COVID positive patients and simply wear the PPE. You know, you sweat underneath that PPE. You cannot change, you cannot touch yourself. There's a very strict protocol for putting on your PPE and for taking it off. People don't go to the toilet for 6 hours at a time because it's so difficult to remove the PPE once you've put it on. And I think as societies, we need to think about the people who save us when we're sick and when we're dying. Mm. The healthcare workers and the risks they take, and the nurses, the doctors, the porters, everybody in a hospital is at risk, even the people making our food in hospitals. So the healthcare system is seriously undervalued and seriously abused in South Africa. Healthcare workers have taken risks on their lives. Many have died in this pandemic, and I don't think we should ever forget that. We've lost highly skilled, highly trained healthcare workers in this pandemic around the world. And we have not appreciated the sacrifices they have made. And it is the healthcare workers that are calling on society to take their vaccines because they have seen too much death and suffering and devastation. They have seen people in ICU who are unvaccinated begging them to save their lives, and they know they cannot do it. So I think having the experience of seeing people die in their hundreds and thousands like never before is what makes healthcare workers passionate about promoting vaccination. And this is why it's so important. And this is why in the fourth wave, the risk of compassion fatigue is really high, because healthcare workers are absolutely exhausted. They've gone without leave. They are burnt out, emotionally and physically burnt out. And they are still trying to treat the unvaccinated in hospitals. But then there's another group of people that is also suffering here, and that is the group of people who have non-COVID diseases. So people are still getting heart attacks and hypertensive crises, and they are getting injuries, and they require surgery. And these people need access to a hospital bed, and they need ICU access sometimes. But when our ICUs are full of unvaccinated COVID patients, then the people who have other diseases are suffering because they cannot get access to a ventilator or to an ICU bed. And I think that's a very serious problem. So for people going around their average lives in society and not having any impact or not knowing or understanding the healthcare system, I think there's a serious misunderstanding of how important this pandemic is and how important it is for people to protect themselves and to be vaccinated.
I suppose as we draw towards the end of the conversation, Prof, I would like you to sort of just emphasize this debate between personal privilege and public peril. Because a lot of us are very much focused on us and what's happening in our own little space or world, and at times we lose sight of what some of the decisions that we make have got a broader impact. In terms of the term you use is personal privilege versus public peril.
Yeah, so I think the actual saying is personal privilege ends where public peril begins. So you may swing your arms, as an example, as long as you don't touch anybody else and affect anybody else. So you have your personal space and you can do what you like with yourself. But as soon as your action impacts on another person, then your rights become limited in some way or another. And so this is an important ethics principle, and it is just an important principle of in terms of life and life philosophies. I mean, we've become such a selfish society. And yet, if you think about it, could we as individuals survive on our own? I don't think that's possible. I think we live in such an interdependent world that we need each other, and we need to be able to function as a cohesive society where there is solidarity, where we look out for each other. And if we can't do that, then we have no chance of survival. It's almost a threat to the survival of humanity if we want to ensure and fight for individual rights all the time. Because there is no such thing. We are always, I mean, even look at our smoking laws. You cannot smoke in your own house if you have a cleaner or a gardener on your property, right? That's how much our legislation even protects others from harm within this. Our rights are limited in more ways than we know. And so we need to ensure, I think our thinking has shifted too much to a Western paradigm of enforcing, trying to enforce individual rights. But if we look at African philosophical systems, they are always communally based. So the health of the community, the rights of the community and of society is important, and we need to think about that. We need to constantly balance my rights as an individual with the rights of my family, the rights of my friends and my society and my community in which I live. So I think it's important that we often need to adjust our thinking to ensure that we understand when we deal with a public health emergency, it's much more than individual rights that's involved.
In closing, Prof, what do you think are the steps that we should be taking to become a lot more aware of how our personal privileges affect or put others in peril? I just think in other areas of our lives, we've largely accepted that. And we're no longer complaining about it. In smoking, it's not a problem now. Everybody knows that they can't light up in the office. They go outside. When we drive on the road, although we're sitting in our own vehicles on our own, we put on a seatbelt. How could we use some of that to actually get all of us to be appreciative of this issue around not so much centered on ourselves, but being part of a bigger community?
Yeah. So I think, look, we need to start in our homes in terms of how we educate our own children. And a lot of childhood education starts in the home. Mm-hmm. So, getting parents and families to talk to their children and, to teach them about respect for others, caring for others. If we talk about religion, all the major religions of the world have something in common. And they teach us to be caring for others and even to sacrifice for others. Mm-hmm. And so if we look at, these common moral principles, they're really important to enforce in children when they're young and they're growing up. Likewise, we need this to run through our school systems, as a thread. We have lots of education about maths and science and geography. And then, there's a little bit on life orientation somewhere thrown in. But we don't have a strong enough focus in our educational system on the moral aspects of life and on ethics. So I think that's important. At university level, I mean, we have lots of ethics teaching and programs that go on that, educate our students at a higher level. But even there in society, I think there's a strong Western influence in many countries around the world where, the American paradigm of individual rights has been imported and is, accepted too easily without question. So it's about questioning some of the things we see on movies. And, if we look at the United States of America, they've been ravaged by this pandemic. And the more they continue, there's a sector in the United States, that continues this rant about individual rights. And those are the people who are dying. And those are the people who are bringing the entire country down because they refuse to comply. And so this is, you know, such a good example for us of what things work in the world and what systems don't work in the world. And so it's important in South Africa, you know, that we call ourselves a rainbow nation. We talk about the fact that, you know, that Ubuntu is important in society, but we don't actually practice it. And I think that's a problem. That's a challenge, and it needs to be addressed at various levels, you know, in society. As I said, starting from very young children and going through all the way to older people and adults as well.
In conclusion, Prof, if you were advising a company of our size, we've got just shy of 600 people in our company, and having differing views on the issue of mandatory vaccination, there are others who believe, there are others who are very resistant about it. What do you think we as a community in a company should be, how do you think we should be approaching this particular issue?
Derek, I think engaging with people is important because sometimes it helps a lot when we have good conversations, you know, with people, especially those who are, as you say, resistant to vaccines. And so continuing to engage, ensuring that there is access to good, reliable information around vaccines, debunking the myths that exist, because there are many myths, and regrettably, they are shared widely on social media. So I think it's important that the misinformation is diluted with good and reliable information about, you know, the benefit of COVID vaccines, not only to individuals, but to all. The understanding must be clear in every work environment that our constitution, you know, supports the right to a safe working environment for all. So, you know, in protecting yourself, you're also protecting others, and you're ensuring that the work environment is safe for everybody. So promoting that kind of understanding is important. And, you know, we don't want to become a society that is divided over this matter, that is intended to protect everybody. So a mandatory vaccine policy should not be seen as punitive. It should be seen as something that is there to protect others, in the same way that a mandatory seatbelt policy is there to protect all in society, or, you know, driving under the influence of alcohol is restricted and smoking in public is restricted. These are all the mandatory policies and laws intended to protect others. And so it's about fostering that spirit of thinking about others as much as we think about ourselves.
Well, Prof, thank you. I mean, that's really been fantastic. I think there's a lot of food for thought here. I'm really struck by the clarification between where does personal privilege end and where does the public peril begin. And really the fact that there's a lot of rights which are not inalienable, that there are rights which are subject to some form of limitation, even in our advanced constitution, which is highly lauded by others in the world, there's an acknowledgement that our rights are not absolute, and those need to be balanced. That is really much appreciated. So thank you very much for joining us, and to the audience, thanks for listening again. We try to continuously engage with relevant experts, and we hope that our expert today gave you some valuable insights that will make us a lot more safer, a lot more productive as members of the standard community and of the broader society, but more importantly, that we learn to accommodate each other's differing views in our rainbow nation, as Prof has have told us. So thank you very much, Prof, and we look forward to our 2022 series where we continue with such important conversations.
Thank you, Derek.
To our listeners on this podcast, Prof. Moodley has written two very important articles, which we'll include in the link to the podcast. The first one is Why COVID-19 Vaccines Should Be Mandatory in South Africa. This was produced and circulated in August this year. And she's also written a one for a medical journal, which refers to compassion fatigues, amongst medical workers, which is an aspect that you touched on. These will be made available as part of the podcast, and we really hope that you'll find them as useful and as complementary to the podcast that we just had today. So thank you all for joining us.
In Discussion with Derek, brought to you by StanLib.